Warning. The podcast you are about to hear contains coarse language and tells stories of witches. Email us at missingwitches@gmail.com if you want to be heard. And blessed be.
You might not expect to hear the name Tori Spelling on the Missing Witches podcast, but she might just be the reason some of you have heard of our next witch. This is the story of how Marie-Thérèse Alourdes Massena Champagne Levinsky, born in Haiti, pregnant at 14, former singer, sex worker, and tobacco inspector, a woman whose own face did not appear on the first edition of her biography, became the most famous voodoo priestess living in the United States today. This is a woman who was given her last rites twice and lived to tell. If you know her, you likely know her as Mama Lola.
You aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch.
Be a witch, be a witch, be a witch, be a witch, be a witch.
You must be a witch.
Mama Lola's biographer, Karen McCarthy Brown, describes her as a strong woman who provides the main financial and emotional support for a hard-pressed family. She's also a fighter, a survivor, who has had a hard life, but nevertheless shows little trace of bitterness from her suffering. She is a presence to be reckoned with, someone who commands the respect of others. But Lola is also a giver, a caring and empathetic person who takes pleasure in helping others. By necessity, she has become adept at balancing this desire to help with the need to care for herself. If you are a woman, an empath, or especially if you are a witch, heck, if you are a decent human, you know that this balance is not easily attained. Some go their whole lives without ever coming close to the kind of compassion and fierceness and awareness and, yes, arrogance in the style of Ipesita Roy Chakraverty that is required to balance self and other. Worse, some never consider that maybe the two, self and other, are one. Going their whole lives without ever knowing what it means to truly care. Mama Lola was born in 1936 in Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. Conceived at a not altogether unfinished time when Haiti was going back and forth, fighting for the power to define its national identity, legalizing and criminalizing and legalizing what were called in the law superstitious practices. There had been a long-standing prohibition of spells as a result of colonization, the Catholic Church, not to mention the near 20-year U.S. military occupation of Haiti that ended in 1934. Stanio Vincent, Haiti's president at the time, maintained a ban on some public ritual, but in 1935 affirmed the right to popular dances. And then Mama Lola was born. Her mother, Philomise Massena, known as Philo, was also somewhat of a reluctant mambo. Mambo, sometimes mambo, is a term for high priestess in the voodoo religion. They are physical and spiritual healers. They give blessings, songs, prayers and advice, clear hexes, lead and perform rituals and ceremonies. One can study and train and go through a complex set of protocols to reach the status of mambo, or one can become mambo, chosen via a dream, dragged underwater, a calling to serve the spirits that cannot be ignored. Any woman who is called, or calls herself mambo, or curandera, or yogini, or ayurveda, or bruja, or sangoma, or witch, is sure to have a personal history rich with complexity and depth. And the history of voodoo itself is infinitely more rich and deep. We've all come across the racist, outdated Western portrayals of voodoo as a dark and evil conjuring of bad spirits and sacrifice to the devil, zombies, bloodlust, black magic. As Milos Rigaud says in his book Secrets of Voodoo, to the uninitiated, voodoo has long been thought of as a primitive form of magic and belief in ghosts. Most of what the average layman knows of voodoo comes only from misleading use of it in Hollywood horror movies and in paperback thrillers that emphasize witch doctors or sticking pins in voodoo dolls. Beyond Rigaud's mention of Hollywood, these images, based on racism and control, demonizing the ancient ways and painting them as bloodthirsty, sick, and savage, have infiltrated Western culture in a very real and tangible way. One particularly troubling example comes from Mama Lola's daughter, Maggie. A patient in the medical office where Maggie once worked, upon learning she was Haitian, refused to allow Maggie to touch her. The reasons the woman gave were voodoo and AIDS. Reasons still used against Haitians today. When you brush away the dirt and cobwebs of religious racist propaganda, the passion, wisdom, and oneness of this universe is revealed. Rigo continues, "The fact is that voodoo encompasses an exceedingly complex religion and magic, with complicated rituals and symbols that have developed for thousands of years, perhaps longer than any other of today's established faiths. The believer in voodoo, and there are millions of blacks and some whites who practice it, centers his hopes and fears as strongly on it as does a follower of Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, or Islam. Indeed, the Haitian atmosphere seems ever impregnated with it, as if with a rich, mystical aroma of Africa, to the extent that individuals as well as families are conscious of voodoo's effect upon their lives with a curious mixture of glory and dread." And so it is that we approach this episode with the same curious mixture of glory and dread. Here we are learning the story of Mama Lola, and we find ourselves in the story of voodoo itself, and thus Ifa, Yoruba, Kemet. It's extremely vast and beautiful, powerful, intimidating territory. So we went looking for the witches we needed to guide us on this journey of discovery, and wow, did we find them. You'll see links to all our teachers on this leg of our path in our show notes, and we encourage you to read their books. To quote Queen Afua from her sacred text, Sacred Woman, "By necessity, sacred woman training provides only a brief introduction to ancient Kamit. For indeed, the serious study of this civilization could take a lifetime. I offer it to you in hopes that you will be so fascinated by the truth of its teachings that you will be inspired to explore more deeply into our rich cultural treasures." We couldn't have put it better. Like Maria Sabina's mushrooms, this podcast will only take you so far. As McCarthy Brown writes in Mama Lola, a voodoo priestess in Brooklyn, "A Lourdes is a superb storyteller. But her stories, as she tells them, do not lend themselves to reproduction in a written text. Each story has a theme, better a refrain, with which she opens and to which she returns time and time again as the story is woven, never in a simple logical or chronological fashion. Each time the refrain is repeated, it signals a new attempt to tell a story. Each attempt seems to capture the whole story. Yet none succeeds because the connections, the meanings, the layers of possible interpretation are too dense to be caught in a single telling. Thus, a Lourdes moves in a spiral fashion, over and over the same ground when telling an important ancestral story. Each pass over familiar turf creates redundancy, but it also brings some additional nuance or detail. To listen, it is necessary to relax with the rhythm and to trust that it will eventually bring her around to fill in the gaps." And it seems like her story must be told in the same spiral fashion. We'll keep coming back to McCarthy Brown's book because it's the most thorough biography of Mama Lola to date, drawing on her, at the time of most recent edition, 36-year friendship with and study of the Mambo. But even McCarthy Brown reminds us in her afterword that Mama Lola once said, "I hate that book because I change and it doesn't." But Mama Lola also said, "I got plenty confidence in myself. You want some too?" So with a yes, please, and thank you, Mama Lola, we present our humble opening of the gateway and spiral back to the beginning of all consciousness, the source of voodoo and its many siblings, Ifa. There's been an eternity of discussion on the birthplace of this great and sacred collection of knowledge. Perhaps the Yoruba of Nigeria are descended from a people who were living on the banks of the Nile in Egypt. Others claim the ancestors had traveled west from Ethiopia. We are definitely not the authority on this subject. But we do know that Western culture has done its weird, racist best to separate in our minds the venerable Egypt from its rightful place in the continent of Africa. So we're way more likely to know something about Kemet than we are about Ifa. Whether the two religions, for lack of a better word, of Ifa and Kemet are sisters, or mother-daughter, they definitely share the same blood, a blend of history, philosophy, medicine, and folklore. And we're looking for witches we've been missing, trying to learn something new and not fuck it up too much. So let's leave the pharaohs in their tombs for now, and just dive on over to the clear blue waters of the Gulf of Guinea and the dream dragged underwater. Our favorite book on Ifa is Ona Agbani, The Ancient Path, by Ialosa Apetibi Aloaomi Osunyemi Akalatunde. She writes, "Ifa has been in practice for some 20,000 years. At the time of this writing in the Western year 2002, according to its annual calendar, the Anago Yoruba Nation itself is 10,045 years old. Those prehistoric civilizations that later merged and became the Anago were the first to practice this ancient way of life. As such, Ifa is the result of thousands of years of painstaking research and observation of nature and humans' relationship to it, as well as humans' relationship with the divine and other humans. The information gathered in this research is compiled in the sacred oral scripture of Ifa known as Odu, and in the DNA of each melanated person as part of their genetic history, the storehouse of information passed from parent to child. According to the primordial observations of our ancestors, all things are part of the divine whole. All things includes objects that most would consider inanimate. There is no spiritual line of demarcation between the so-called sacred and the so-called secular. Everything that is granted the power to exist is holy, a part of the divine whole. In her glossary, which she refers to as a note about bara or the use of word sound power in this book, Akalatunde makes a distinction between holy, and her spelling holy, W-H-O-L-Y, which is kind of a mix of the former too, part of the divine whole, part of the all. She says, our ancestors Africanized elements of English so that we can retain the power of the spoken word, called bara in the Yoruba language. I also take the liberty of spelling some words differently so that they will house the vibration that I am trying to create with them. Hopefully our reading will house that vibration that Akalatunde seeks with her words when she writes, Ifa is known simply as Yoruba here in the West. Ifa and its spiritual siblings from neighboring cultures have many bicultural offspring as a result of the maafa, a key Swahili term meaning great disaster, used to denote the rape of Africa and the resulting slavery and colonization. Some of the more well-known and often misrepresented progeny are Santeria, Lukumia, Voodoo, Obeya, Hoodoo, Conjure, Rootworking, and to a much lesser degree, Black Church. These offspring represent the mixture of African culture with Native American culture, with elements of Eurocentric Christianity thrown in. Our enslaved ancestors used these spiritual systems to protect themselves and their families during captivity. Therefore, hoodoo, voodoo, rootworking, and any other practice that contained African spiritual elements were deemed wicked and evil by the slave masters. Akalatunde goes on later in the book to explain the presence of Eurocentric Christian elements, these being particularly visible in Santeria, where Catholic saints with relatable traits were used as substitutes for orishas to allow for a more public worship. She writes, with the Maafa, in which millions of Africans were captured and placed in captivity, our ties to our villages were severed and the priests and priestesses were thrust together. This catastrophe forced them to merge all of their wisdom into one common practice. Maafa marked the beginning of Ifa in its current Western state. This form is known as Orisa worship, Santeria, worship of the saints, Sango Baptiste, Lukumi, Makumba, and a myriad of other names. Many of these practices also added Native American elements that were introduced to the practitioners on these shores. These new practices were also forced to include Euro-Christian elements, which allowed the ancestors to camouflage their practices and thereby survive in an environment created to destroy them. And so it went that Maafa exported Ifa across the world in the most terrible way, through the bodies and spirits of the slave trade. Ifa has always been passed down via practice, DNA, and Odu, the oral tradition. But with Maafa, the necessity of an oral tradition became especially important. Because of this, many words have a variety of spellings and pronunciations. Spirits go by many names. Mixed up and redistributed, the words and names may be different, but the concepts are largely the same, and in fact, have much in common with the Western contemporary notions of paganism and witchcraft that they no doubt influenced, or more likely begat. Herbalism, meditation, earth and sky-based spiritual systems, offerings, gratitude, manifestation, and dreams. But Ifa, and especially Voodoo, have their faith woven into a complex and deeply public, personal, whole-life relationship with Lua. The Lua must be paid. Lua, also known by many other names, including Les Mystères and the Invisibles, are spirit realm representatives of the One. Olodumare, Bondier, the sum total of all consciousness, Some speculate that it was an ancient foreign misunderstanding of this notion of oneness that led to the monotheisms of what we know today as Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Luwak can be understood as kind of akin to spirit guides from all cultures. Jinn in Islam, for example, not angels, because the binaric opposition of good and evil doesn't hold as much space here. So not angels, but ancestors. More like messengers, receiving and delivering messages to and from Bondye. Messages are sent from humanity to the divine via service, prayer, offerings, dance, drums, and many multitude of other thoughts and actions. But again, the Luwak must be paid. A lot of the ritual of voodoo takes the form of specific offerings to specific Luwak. They each have their own tastes. There is much contemporary discussion of Orisha and Luwak, as they are not synonymous. Or they kind of are, or they definitely aren't. Again, the necessity of oral tradition after Mafa means there is no one set of rules, or of spellings, or of names, or terms, or gods. As Nigerian Babalawo, high priest in Ifa, Osuniye Alajide Ifa Tunmo writes, people often ask me if there is a complete written copy of the Odu Ifa. However, within the Odu Ifa, it explains that there is no Babalawo who knows all of the Odu Ifa, because the pages in the Odu Ifa are infinite. It is like asking if there is a complete written copy of the science of the universe. No such book could ever be written. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't books about science or condensed versions of the Odu Ifa. Of Ifa's connection to voodoo, Karen McCarthy Brown writes, it can be argued that Haitian voodoo is closer to its African roots than most other forms of New World African religion. Voodoo's closer ties to its African origins are primarily a result of Haiti's virtual isolation from the rest of the world for nearly a century following its successful slave revolution. Haiti has a truly remarkable history of survival, magic, and resistance. Legend has it that it was the Orisha Ogun who planted the idea of a revolt into the heads of Haitian slaves and Maroons, a term for Africans who had escaped from slavery, mixed with indigenous people, and formed independent settlements. And it was Ogun, aka Papa Ogu, who helped them to victory in the Haitian Revolution of 1804. If you want a primer on the Orishas, maybe check out Seven African Powers, the Orishas, by Monique Joyner Sidlack. It's a great quick jumping-off point for study. She says, collectively, these seven Orishas symbolize a force that offers guidance and strength during all our troubles and hardships. She writes of Ogun as having the status of a protective father figure. Ogun is the Orisha of tools and weapons. Ogun gives strength and protection to individuals with a conflict to battle. This conflict is a power and identity struggle that dates back to 1492 when Columbus and crew arrived on Haiti, original land, mountain land, and renamed it Hispaniola, and having brought no women on their ships, took the women of Haiti by force, and finding no gold, turned to agriculture and human trafficking. This pushing, pulling, toil, and trouble of oppression and rebellion leads us forward through the layers of space and time back to the Haiti of 1936 and the birth of Mama Lola, a baby girl born a lourdes with all the wit and fire of her people's history in her blood. She comes from a line of healers, Mambos and Hugan, and most have stories of trying to ignore the call. But when Luwak or Orisha make contact, attention must be paid. They manifest in visions, coincidences, but most likely and profoundly through dreams and even possession. Her grandfather and grandmother, Philo's mother and father, were legendarily magical. Grandpa was prone to drunken rage and specialized in revenge magic. He only spoke to the spirits when he wanted something. The story goes that when he died suddenly in the street, Sina, Mama Lola's grandmother, said, "It is better this way. I know the spirits want me. Before I always said no. Now everything has changed. Now I will serve the spirits. They will take care of me. I do not need a man." This may have been a prophecy for the generations of women to come in her family line. Philo's gift of healing at first showed itself exclusively through dreams. Solutions came to her, appearing in her head as spirit messages. But the vocation of healer, a job that for her could only be successfully performed upon receipt of a message in a dream that may or may not come, didn't exactly make for financial stability. Over time, though, Philo owned her craft, eventually becoming knowledgeable enough so she no longer had to wait for dream state instructions before counseling a client. She makes a name for herself as a mambo, at one point even counseling future President François Duvalier. But her generosity kept her from attaining wealth. Giving money away, paying others overdue rent, feeding their children, these were all common practices for Philo. Mama Lola's daughter, Maggie, says, "Work with the spirit run in my family, my grandmother, my mother, people coming in here to see my mother all hour of the day and night. She never too tired to see people, just like my grandmother, always helping people. They don't ever have no money, they just giving, always giving." Mama Lola claims that her mother never spoke of her father until one day, walking, a friend of Philo pointed to a man and told Dolores, "That's your daddy." The child had never seen this man before in her life. When she questioned her mother, Philo told her that her father hadn't given one penny toward her upbringing. Mama Lola claims that the man didn't admit that he was her father until shortly after she won a small lottery. But his was also a family of Hugen, so perhaps by DNA, if not upbringing, Mama Lola had magic on both sides of her family tree. At 7 years old, Mama Lola had one of the most defining experiences of her life, which is funny because she says she doesn't remember it at all. One day she was badly bitten by the neighbor's dog. That night, leg carefully bandaged by her mother, Alurdes woke in a panic. Her head was spinning. Something was dreadfully wrong. She had to move. She got out of bed and walked and walked and walked. The frantic need to escape was the last thing Mama Lola remembers about the incident. She went missing in every sense. Trying to diffuse Philo's desperate fears, a friend joked, "Perhaps the spirits have taken Alurdes below the water. Maybe they want to make her mambo." There are stories about the voodoo Loa La Sirene, that she will pull people down under the water, en bas de l'eau. If you speak French, you might understand this as en bas de l'eau, literally underwater, and she might force you to live there with her, connecting you through the water to all knowledge, all life. McCarthy Brown describes, "The stories have a common pattern. A person, usually a woman, disappears for a time. 3 days, 3 months, 3 years. When she returns, she is a changed person. She has gained sacred knowledge. Living below the water where spirits instructed her in the arts of diagnosis and healing. I once met a rural priestess. When I asked her who had initiated her, she responded that no one had. Her instructions, she said simply, had come en bas de l'eau." At 7 years old, Alurdes disappeared for 3 days. This, combined with all these other weird bits of evidence that you should go and read about, suggests that maybe Mama Lola gained her true title of Mamba en bas de l'eau during those 3 days. In the end, she was found unharmed by the water. Her first job at age 16 was as a singer in Haiti's Troupe Folklorique, and not much is made of this time except that her singing career was well paid and ended when she got married. We do know that it was popular at the time for tourists visiting Haiti to want to see a voodoo dance, so this was maybe another prophetic time in her life, drawing her slowly to her past and to her future. Spiral forward, and Mama Lola is living on her own with two children in Port-au-Prince. She looks for work, eventually gaining employment through the government-run tobacco industry. She said, "Let me tell you something. When you go to the office and ask for a job, that man, the inspector, the one in the head office, if he say, 'Yes, I'm going to give you the job,' you have to sleep with him first. You say no, you don't have no job. Sometimes they make love to you, and you still don't have no job. Sometimes when I think back, I get angry. But that's life. I can't help it. That's life." When she loses her job as a tobacco inspector, she's forced to sell sex more directly and frequently. Though she's quick to make a distinction between her role as a Marie-Jacques, or like escort, and a bouzen, or street prostitute. She goes on dates with men, dinner, dancing, and then sex. Interestingly, she would approach payment in the same way she would later as a mambo. She gives what she can and accepts what she's given in return. Back then, there was no other way for her to buy food or pay her rent or her children's school fees. Sex work is not the defining moneymaker in her life, certainly, and we might have glossed over it if not for Mama Lola's own words to Karen McCarthy Brown. "You gotta put that in the book, because it's the truth, right? Women gotta do all kind of thing, right? I do that to feed my children, and I am not ashamed. Of course, women having to sell their bodies is nothing new. One woman McCarthy Brown met in Haiti joked that she was going to market to sell her land. When asked what land, the woman hooted and grabbed her crotch, laughing, "I can sell my land anywhere." But the power and resilience of Haitian women is also notorious, no more notorious than anywhere else. Perpetua Cherry writes in her essay, "Feminist is a Dirty Word in Haiti." On April 3, 1986, shortly after the end of the Duvalier regime, more than 30,000 women from diverse backgrounds took to the streets of Port-au-Prince to demand to be included in Haiti's return to democracy. The 1986 march, organized by more than a dozen grassroots groups, called attention to sexual and gender-based violence, women's financial exclusion, lack of access to health and education, among other issues. For many women who participated in this march, including my mother, it was the first time they felt socially empowered. Despite a few critics, the event was well-received and marked the renewal of Haiti's women's movement, eventually contributing to the creation of the Ministry of Women's Affairs and Women's Rights, Haiti's participation in the 1995 Beijing Conference, and the ratification of the Belém do Pará Convention. When Alurdis was in her 20s with two children in Port-au-Prince, life was hard. She had become pregnant for the third time, not by a client, but by a dear and trusted friend and lover. He deserted her when he found out she was carrying his child. She says she and her children went to bed hungry on more days than she'd like to remember. This third child, a son, William, was born with meningitis. Mama Lola took him to the hospital and was given a prescription for drugs she couldn't afford to buy. The lights turned off from non-payment, she sat in the dark, cradling her sick child in her arms, weeping. So when she asked her brother living in New York for money and he instead gave her the option to join him, she packed her bags and arrived in Brooklyn in 1962 with stars in her eyes. Before she left, she told her mother, "I'm going to that city, a lot of stars, beautiful, oh boy, and I don't think I'm going to need no spirit in New York." She laughs. And I was wrong. Even her first attempt to apply for a visa was greeted by the American embassy official with a sneer. "How do I know you're not going there to work as a prostitute? How do I know if this man is your pimp and not your brother?" So maybe this unwelcome should have tipped Mama Lola off to what was to come. She leaves her three children in the care of her mother Philo and arrives in Brooklyn in 1962. By December of 1963, she's dying. "Before Christmas, I feel sick. My stomach, my chest. Oh boy, I can't sit down. I can't lay down. I can't stand up. I can't breathe also. I feel I'm going to die. I say, 'God, please save me. God, what happened to me?' Then I think of my three children in Haiti, my mother, my family. They bring me to Jewish Hospital in Prospect Avenue. I got fever of 106, and they put me in emergency room. I was so sick, and I don't get better." On January 8th, the priest arrives in her room to give Mama Lola her last rites. Diagnosed with an infection in her intestine, she's operated on, kept in hospital for a couple more weeks, then discharged. Or as she put it, "I feel all right. They put me out." "You know, when you come from the hospital, you're supposed to go back for treatment, but I don't go back because they ask me, 'Bring your passport and alien card.' They ask me, 'Where your family live in Haiti?' They ask me that. And I give the address, but when I tell my friend Carmen, she say, 'Oh yeah, if you go with your alien card and your passport, they go and write the government in Haiti, make them pay. Because when you operate, it's very expensive, and I don't have no money to pay.' She say, 'They're going to send you back to Haiti.' I get scared, so I never go back. That time, I don't know what is welfare. I don't know about welfare at all, and nobody don't tell me. No, nobody don't tell me if you're sick, you're not working, you can go someplace, they can help you. Nobody tell me that. But everybody friend help me. You see me, you give me $2, $3. If I come in your house, you give me a plate of food, you know. That's the way I survive." Mama Lola continues, "When I leave Jewish Hospital, I'm okay. I eat until I got my strength back. That time I go back to work. But 3 months after, I get sick again. I get sick again. Same system, same time. They call priest again. They give me last rite again. That's twice I got last rite. Twice. This time they tell me I got bad heart. I got all kinds of sickness. But it's not true. When I come from Wyckoff Hospital, I got no place to live because I don't have no money. I can't pay no rent. So I meet a lady in the street, Yvonne Constant. She know my family in Haiti. She say, 'How come you so skinny? Poor girl, come into my house.' That lady give me a big plate of food when I reach her house. Woy, rice and bean, a big fish, boiled plantain. I eat, sweetheart. She give me food, she give me place to live. I sleep in her house and she give me food. I don't know what happened. I always sleeping and I can't work. One day somebody tell me, Beatrice want to see you. Beatrice, my sister-in-law. Sunday afternoon, I got clothes on me and I go there. When I first come to New York, I live in her house. But we don't get along too good and I don't see her for a long time. Long time. You know me, I don't go to people I know to ask or beg for nothing. So I see her, I just say, Aunt Bebe, people tell me you was asking for me. What happened? My mother? Something in my family? She say, no, nothing don't happen in your family. I want to see you because I got a dream about you. I say, oh yeah? And very serious. She say, I don't know if it's serious or not. She say, I dream, I see a mountain man on 42nd Street. She say, in that dream, she have to cross that street and everybody's standing just waiting for the light. She look at that man, she say, they got mountain man in New York too? When they give the green light, she just walk. And one lady behind her say, hey madam, 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 that man call you. Baby say, what man? When she turn her head, she see the mountain man. She went to the mountain man and she tell the mountain man, hi. And he say, hi cousin. And baby say, you want to speak to me? And he say, yes cousin. And he tell baby, you know Philo? Baby said, Philo, yeah. Did you know Lourdes? Baby say, yeah, I know Lourdes. And the mountain man say, tell Lourdes if she dressed like me, everything gonna be beautiful. Baby say, really? And that man walk maybe 3 or 4 step, and baby don't see him no more. And boom, the clock. And she say, what time is it? It was 6:30 in the morning. And when she wake up, baby say, ah, I understand that dream. I understand. I have to see Lourdes to explain her that. Because she know my mother have spirit, you know. So she say, maybe Lourdes' mother's spirit come and talk to me. Maybe that man, Cousin Zaka. Cousin, Creole for cousin, Zaka, is the Haitian loa. Baby recognized him because his color is blue, especially blue denim, the outfit of a Haitian peasant. He's excellent to talk to in regards to herbs and herbal medicine. So when Mama Lola heard her sister-in-law's dream, she knew what she had to do. She had to return to Haiti. But we gotta stop and talk about zombies. Because white supremacist patriarchy creates and feeds fears. And we gotta name and shame them every time we see them. Witch, zombie, mummy, these are the creatures that populate our nightmares. Through fright tales and horror movies, ancestors and their beliefs are turned to monsters. To be feared, but not revered. In her book, Haitian Voodoo, Mambo Chita Tan gives us a brief history of the zombie. She writes, in the West African language called Kikongo, the word Nsambe means God or spirit. Haitians believe that in addition to the physical body and the animate force that makes a living body different from a corpse, there is also a special spirit within a person, their eternal soul. Members of the secret society are believed to know how to dislodge a person's soul from his body. This dislocation renders that person barely living, incapable of anything other than basic function. The term zombie has come to mean either the soul that has been stolen and enslaved before or after physical death, or the living person whose soul has been stolen and enslaved in such a manner. So it's especially heinous that colonizers should enslave people and then demonize even the word that came to denote a soul, also stolen and enslaved. We're reminded of a drug derived from seeds and essentially weaponized by Colombian criminals known as the devil's breath. The drug puts people into a zombie-like state. They lose both their memory and free will, blindly following instructions to empty their bank accounts, or give up their keys to their homes or cars, waking up in a park 2 or 3 days later with no memory of what they'd been led to do. If you're feeling cynical about voodoo or zombies, you might not be as safe as you think, because the capture of a soul doesn't just happen through magic or voodoo or crime or even mafia. A soul can be enslaved by any constant cutting down from the all-too-real world we live in. The person who had been so beat up and put down that they no longer have the strength or energy to care. For the science-minded among us, let's cite The Atlantic from an article titled How Poverty Changes the Brain. The brain's limbic system processes emotions and triggers emotional responses, in part because of its storage of long-term memory. When a person lives in poverty, the limbic system is constantly sending fear and stress messages to the prefrontal cortex, which overloads its ability to solve problems, set goals, and complete tasks in the most efficient ways. So maybe we should be less afraid of being eaten alive by walking dead zombies and more afraid of what happens when a mind and soul are enslaved. Lucky for Mama Lola, or as Zaka, Loi, and Bondier would have it, someone did care. Many did. And Yvonne Constant paid Alorzis' passage back to Haiti when it was her turn for Hands. Hands is a community-based financial exchange, a sort of good-natured, well-intentioned relative of the pyramid scheme. If there are 10 of you and you each put in $10 a week, then each week for 10 weeks someone gets $100. Except in Hands, there's no pyramid. Just a circle of protection and love. When Alourdes arrives unannounced in Haiti, her mother sees her and faints. Philo had also had a dream about her daughter returning, broken, from the United States. Within a few days of Mama Lola's return, Philo had been possessed by Papa Ogu. This is not uncommon among Mambos, when the priestess becomes what's known as a horse, and the Loa becomes the rider. Not dissimilar to the concept of the zombie, but this time it's a temporary possession, not sinister, used only to deliver a message or instructions from the divine. This time the message was for Mama Lola. She said, "Papa Ogu, come in my mother's head and tell me I'm supposed to see with card. You know, do spirit work, help people." That I don't like. I say, "Oh boy, how am I going to do that? Because to help people, you got to know a lot of thing." I say, "How am I going to put all that in my head?" My mother tell me, "Don't worry, you'll manage." Mama Lola followed this instruction and still today uses an ordinary or extraordinary deck of playing cards as her primary tool for divination. Karen McCarthy Brown describes the process of initiation and Mama Lola's part in it. She writes, "Initiation into the voodoo priesthood involves an elaborate set of rituals, the core of which is a long period of seclusion in which a person is said to couche, literally to lie down or go to sleep. These rituals are commonly referred to as taking the ason, that is, taking up the beaded rattle that is said to give priests and priestesses a certain amount of leverage in working with the spirits. The initiation rituals for Alourdes could not take place right away. Money had to be saved for drummers, sacrificial animals, food and drink for the spirits. Several sets of ritual clothing had to be sewn. Thus, on this first visit, only a simple ritual, called a lave-tête, a head washing, was performed. The head washing was a promise, Alourdes made to the spirits, indicating that she had heard their request and intended to honor it. The ritual also cooled the rest of spirits in Alourdes' head and fed and strengthened them. After 2 weeks, she returned to New York, but before she left, she promised the spirits that she would return to Haiti to couche as soon as she had $700. The spirits eased their discipline, and although life in New York continued to be demanding, there was a noticeable turn in her luck after this first trip to Haiti. Before she left New York, Alourdes had been unable to find employment, but on the day after her return, she found a job in the laundry at the Brooklyn Hebrew Home, a position she held for 2 years. During this interim period, Alourdes also moved step by step into the role of healer. "I start to help people, you know, little by little, start to do things. You my friend, you got trouble, you know, anything, love, sickness, you come to me, I help a little bit. I try to help. Everything I do for them is good. No complaint. People start to give me money, you know, $5, $10, because they're grateful. So one day I say to myself, I don't have no time to go to that job. So I quit that job and I just work in my house. I read card, I help people." During this time, Alourdes drew on skills acquired during the short visit with her mother, on her awakening memory, and on the help of spirits who began to speak to her more directly through her dreams. "My mother tell me, now you're going to see the real person. Somebody come in your house, they happy, you know, dancing, drinking. Even they do that, you're going to see if they sad. They got something bad inside them, you're going to see that." Finally, when Alourdes had saved $700, she returned to Haiti to take the ason. "Second time I go, I pass 1 month in Haiti. 9 day inside that little room where they couche me. Then I am Mambo. When I come back to New York, people pouring all over me. People who lose job, I make them find job. People who sick, I treat them. Their husband or wife leave them, I make that person come back. After I come back from Haiti second time, I do not have to go to work outside again. My mother showed me how to do good. Never do bad in your life, because when you do bad to people, that return to you. That return right on your back. I remember every single thing she told me because that's in my family. My great-grandmother served spirit, and my grandmother, then my mother, then me. Some people got spirit in their family, but when they grow up, they think they're too big shot to serve that spirit. They're too ashamed about that. But I'm not ashamed at all, because I love spirit, because they help me. That's my belief. By the 1970s, Mama Lola is a renowned mambo, called upon by people in need both in Haiti and the U.S., or by her initiates when a case proved too tough to crack. The black mambo, dressed all in white, trekking across cursed fields and broken hearts with her pail of Florida water, limes, ashes, indigo, molasses. This is the Mama Lola that Karen McCarthy met and studied. The first edition of Mama Lola, a voodoo priestess in Brooklyn, came out in 1991, and the book served to fuel Mama Lola's already growing fame. Each edition after the first would feature her proud, beautiful, wise, do no harm but take no shit expression. Mama Lola accompanied McCarthy Brown on educational tours and fact-finding missions for years. She would continue to go back and forth to Haiti from time to time, from Brooklyn to Port-au-Prince and around the world, speaking, helping, building her reputation, building her power. Her last trip to Haiti was in 2009. A magnitude 7 earthquake struck Haiti on the afternoon of January 12, 2010. More than 500,000 people were injured or killed, with millions more displaced. One more disaster in a country that continues to suffer from centuries of political, economic, social, and environmental injustices and setbacks and inequalities. The earthquake was a disaster that would cause Mama Lola to claim she would never return to Haiti, her mother's home. Holy space and family altar destroyed, she said, there is nothing left. In the new millennium, Mama Lola took up practice at Voodoo Authentica, a voodoo shop, museum, and spiritual center in New Orleans, giving blessings and readings and performing other mumbly duties with her daughter Maggie and goddaughter Brandy, a role the shop calls Voodoo Ambassador. Brandy says, Mama Lola just has this presence that says, I know who I am and I am voodoo. If you come to Mama Lola, you are part of her. We reached out to the staff at Voodoo Authentica, who told us that as of 2016, Mama Lola is officially retired. She's no longer performing any kind of spiritual work or readings, at least not for the public. But the staff assured us that they are in frequent contact with Mama Lola, and she is well and living with her family. We can't leave New Orleans voodoo without spiraling past one of its most famed practitioners, Marie Laveau. Both Amy and I have visited her grave in St. Louis Cemetery on separate occasions. And there's always evidence of the faithful who have passed by before, leaving offerings, as we did, of tobacco, marijuana, crosses and cards, flowers or coins. At some point, drawing X's on her grave became the habit of those visitors seeking Marie Laveau's help from beyond. But this damages the tomb and is discouraged by preservationists. In 2014, a restoration of her tomb was completed. A large fine is now in place for any visitor who attempts to write on the grave.
You've been warned.
So let's spiral the story backward one more time to 2007, at the doors of a sprawling California starlit mansion. Maybe as you enter, you roll your eyes and wonder what Mama Lola is doing there. On this day, in this place, a lourdes might say to you, as she has said in the past, I just do what I want. Nobody don't tell me my business. What they mean? White people can't have no spirit? Spirit for everybody! While it's clear that Mama Lola's relationship with Tori Spelling deserves no more than a footnote in her rich history, we can't help but remark on the absurd balance that life and magic can produce. And it's frankly glorious to see Tori, the poster child for moneyed white privilege, trusting and recognizing the power of the Haitian mambo. And maybe we can admit to getting a bit of a postmodern thrill from watching Mama Lola pelt Tori with her special blend of herbs, oils, and ice-cold water. We'll link you to the video in the show notes. But the best part of Mama Lola's interaction with the star of Beverly Hills is the manner in which Alourdes replies to Tori's complaints. It's cold! Tori shrieks. It's not cold, Mama Lola states back, matter-of-factly, and with authority, as if her speaking the words quite simply makes them true. The water is not cold. Tori stops complaining. Mama Lola's words have changed reality. Your words, you know, can change someone's reality. We all know this. And we all need help sometimes. We all need to care and be cared for. And we should all aspire to a Mama Lola level of balance between caring for ourselves and caring for others. So as we send you off to praise your ancestors and ruminate on the notion of care in your own healing journey, we ask Alegba, safekeeper of Ashe, ruler of doorways, standing at the crossroads of human and divine, to bless us and you as we offer up a splash of Florida water and a quote from Mama Lola one last time. I help all the people, big people, small people, poor people. I'm there to help anybody, anybody, and all the people I help become my friend, my family. Papa Legba, open the gate.
You must be a witch.
Thanks for listening to the Missing Witches podcast. If you like our podcast, please share it with your witchy friends or your witchy aunts. Like, subscribe, follow us on social media at Missing Witches. And as always, don't forget to join us on Wednesday for another episode of Witches Found. This week, I continue my conversation with Phoenix. So that's Missing Witches Sundays, Witches Found Wednesdays, missingwitches.com at Missing Witches.